From WJFF in Jeffersonville, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, blood crisis. Dozens of hospitals and trauma centers across the country say they're in dire need of blood donations after what the American Red Cross is now calling a nationwide blood crisis. We talked to Mia Hubbard from the Red Cross about what's causing the blood shortage and how you can help. On the front lines, hospitals are also near a breaking point with the latest influx of COVID patients. We chat with the director of patient services at Wayne Memorial Hospital in Honesdale, who says it's the worst she's seen since the pandemic began. Fire safety. Those deadly residential fires in the news are prompting firefighters to remind folks about what to do in a fire. We speak with White Lake Fire Company's Brendan Cunningham. And mystical stitches. Christy Johnson tells us about mystical garments and textile talismans. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. Beginning today, anyone with private health insurance can get up to 8 free at-home COVID tests a month. And by Wednesday, the federal government is making available 4 free at-home tests per household. The free tests come as some 25% of healthcare workers have become infected, adding to the strain on hospitals. That's according to infectious disease specialist Dr. Michael Osterholm.
We are about to exceed the highest number of hospitalizations for COVID that we've had at any time since the pandemic began. That includes an ever-increasing number of individuals in the intensive care unit.
The CDC is updating its mask guidance to say N95s offer the best protection against COVID-19 and are now in more abundant supply. A winter storm moving in from the Midwest is threatening to bring snow and ice to parts of the South, the Mid-Atlantic, and the Northeast this weekend. At least a dozen states are under a winter storm watch, and NPR's Dave Mistich reports that some are also under a state of emergency declared by their governors.
2 to 5 inches of snow is forecast across many southern states, with as much as a foot expected in higher elevations. Dangerous driving conditions and power outages are expected as a result of freezing rain and heavy snow. A winter storm watch will be in effect from parts of Arkansas, stretching all the way to Pennsylvania. Some areas are under a winter storm warning. The National Weather Service says snow is expected to hit the south as early as midday Saturday, with the storm making its way northeast through Monday morning. Dave Mistich, NPR News.
To the South Pacific, an underwater volcano erupted today off the island nation of Tonga, prompting tsunami warnings across the region. Ashley Westerman reports that today's eruption is the second for the volcano in less than a month.
Photos and video on social media Saturday show miles-high plumes of ash mixed with lightning swirling in the air above Hunga Tunga volcano. The U.S. Tsunami Warning System rated the eruption as a magnitude 7.6 earthquake. Afterward, the Tongan government issued a tsunami warning, and it wasn't long before video emerged on Twitter of the country's largest island, Tongatapu, being battered by large waves and rained on by ash. Fiji, New Zealand, and Samoa were among the island nations to also issue tsunami warnings. American Samoa was also under a warning, but it has since been dropped. Hunga Tunga last erupted in late December, but Tongan officials say this latest activity was 7 times more powerful. For NPR News, I'm Ashley Westerman in Manila.
There are no immediate reports of injuries in Tonga, and the extent of the damage is unclear as communications remain problematic. New Zealand's military, however, says it's monitoring the situation and remains on standby if asked to assist. In Hawaii, the National Weather Service says there has been minor flooding, but no reported damage. You're listening to NPR News. Supporters of tennis star Novak Djokovic gathered near the Australian Open venue in Melbourne today.
We want Novak Djokovic to play! Let him play!
Djokovic is back at an Australian immigration hotel taken there today while he waits for tomorrow's court hearing that will determine whether he will be deported for not being vaccinated against COVID-19. Were allowed to defend his Australian Open title. The tournament begins Monday. Stocks fell for a second straight week. NPR's David Gura reports that inflation and the prospect of aggressive action from the Federal Reserve continue to weigh on Wall Street.
Stocks continue to suffer in 2022. For the second straight week, the Dow and the S&P lost ground. It's the third week for the Nasdaq. The Labor Department said consumer prices surged at their fastest pace since 1982. The Federal Reserve has predicted it may raise interest rates 3 times this year, but some analysts believe the Fed may need to raise them more aggressively. At his nomination hearing for a second term as chairman of the Fed, Jerome Powell doubled down on his commitment to curbing inflation. Shares of JPMorgan Chase and Citigroup dropped after they reported profits for the last quarter of 2021 that were lower than expected. David Gura, NPR News, New York.
Ahead of Monday's King Day holiday, the eldest son of Martin Luther King Jr. and other civil rights leaders are expected to participate in a voting rights rally in Phoenix today. Voting legislation is stalled in Congress. Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema, one of two Democrats opposed to Democratic efforts to change the Senate's filibuster rules. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Moan, thanking the people who make public radio great every day and also those who listen. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Radio Chatsville. I'm Tim Bruno. The Red Cross said in a statement this week that the dangerously low blood supply levels are posing a concerning risk to patient care, resulting in medical staff making difficult decisions on who receives blood transfusions and who will need to wait until more blood is readily available. In recent weeks, the Red Cross, which provides nearly 40% of the nation's blood, said it had less than a one-day supply of critical blood types and has had to limit blood product distributions to hospitals. We spoke to Mia Hubbard of the American Red Cross about what's causing the shortage.
I am a disaster manager for Eastern New York region. I'm also a disaster coordinator for the Western New York region, which includes Sullivan County. And I am a blood drive ambassador and scheduler for Sullivan County. So I wear a lot of hats.
You do. Now, earlier this week on Tuesday, the American Red Cross declared a national blood crisis, saying the nation is facing its worst blood shortage in more than a decade. What is causing this national blood crisis?
In short form, it's staff shortages and people not being able to donate because they have been sick or, you know, they can't get to a drive for whatever reason. They're quarantining. But I think the biggest thing is this, the national staff shortage that has hit every facet of America has also hit the Red Cross. And so when we're sending out a team to run a blood drive where we might have had 8 blood drives in Sullivan County or 5 blood drives in Sullivan County in a month, we're now averaging 2 or 3 because we don't have the staff to man them. We have people who are having to quarantine, staff that are having to quarantine, so they can't go out to a blood drive, obviously. They would infect a whole lot of people. And so now you've just reduced the number of people you can send to that blood drive, and that means you need to reduce the number of blood drives. We've had blood drives being canceled because either there was a quarantine in effect at the location the blood drive was going to be held, or there's too many staff out because of COVID. And it's just become a big problem. People are not coming out the way they were when we declared an emergency last year. Last year, when everybody was home and not back to work, they were coming out in droves. We were hosting a blood drive that was supposed to have, say, 40, and we were getting 60 people showing up saying, I want to donate blood. Well, they were home. They weren't going anywhere. We still had staff. Right now, we don't.
And the impact is pretty large. I mean, the Red Cross provides 40% of the nation's blood. So
it does.
This is causing hospitals to limit blood distribution, is that right?
Well, the other part of the story is that hospitals began doing elective surgeries again. So that reduced the amount of blood that was available for emergencies because some of it was being used for elective surgeries. Now hospitals are having to go back to limiting those elective surgeries because they have to have the blood available for the car accident that comes in, the person who has cancer, the, you know, all those things that are needed on a daily basis. If you don't have the blood for those, the guy who needs a hernia operation may be able to wait, but the person who just had a horrific car accident can't.
And one of the other things that the American Red Cross mentioned when declaring this national blood crisis, as you mentioned, that there's been this decline, but what struck me was that there was a 62% drop in college and high school blood drives during the pandemic. That's got to be a significant impact as well.
It absolutely is. But think about it. During the pandemic, schools were closed down. During the height of the pandemic last year, schools were closed down completely. So nobody was going in. We were very lucky in that during the summer of 2020, Monticello High School was able to let us use their gym because you could enter and exit from the outside to that one room, and then they could COVID clean it. So they were able to let us use it to host blood drives there. We were super lucky there. But once the kids went back to school, that was not the case. They can't take the chance on somebody coming in who may or may not have COVID and possibly shutting the whole school down. So I certainly get it. It's just frustrating because blood drives at schools were an integral part of where we collected blood.
And how has the winter weather across the country impacted the blood supply?
Well, if people can't travel, they can't get to a blood drive. If the staff can't travel safely from, say, Binghamton, where our blood collection center is, down to Sullivan County, we have to cancel a blood drive. So far, we have not been impacted by that this weekend, knock on wood. This winter, I'm okay. but it's happened 2 years in a row. I had a December blood drive canceled because we had snow and they could not safely travel down to the site. Plus, even if they did get there, how many of our donors were going to show up?
Well, and this weekend, sub-zero temperatures, a wind chill warnings, and a snowstorm on the way, too. So hopefully there is nothing coming up this weekend. We'll talk about what's coming up. But by declaring this historic crisis, you're really upping the urgency about this. So what is the Red Cross asking for, and how can folks go about that? And then what's coming up in the area? What's scheduled?
So Red Cross is asking that anyone who is eligible to donate blood, anyone who is able to donate blood, please look for a local blood drive. Some of them in our local area, and Sullivan County has always been really, really good at collecting blood. We've always been really good at filling our blood drives to capacity or close to capacity, but other areas not so much. If you can, look on redcrossblood.org or download the app to your phone, which is the blood donor app, and take a look and see where there are drives running around you. You can schedule it right online. You can call 1-800-RED-CROSS. You can do it on the app, which is really kind of fun because there's lots of extra things on the app to do. And it's simple. Once you get to the blood drive, there's a donor ambassador there, and we're always looking for volunteers to help with that, too. The donor ambassador is going to help you sign in. You're going to have a quick little mini health history, and then you're going to get on the table. The whole process takes under an hour. And if we could get every blood drive filled, we could certainly not eliminate the emergency, but we could make a dent in it.
And is there a particular type of blood that you're in need of right now, an urgent need?
Well, they're always looking for O, because O is the universal donor. So if you have O, please, please, please sign up. And if you're eligible to do Power Reds, which they take the equivalent of a double unit, but they don't actually take two units of blood from you. Just know that. if you are eligible to do that, please do, because in just an extra 10, 15 minutes, you can have given the equivalent of 2 pints of blood. And then instead of coming back in 60 days, you come back in 120 days, or instead of 2 months, 4 months. And this way we can in a short amount of time take what would have been 2 hours worth of work to get 2 pints of blood. Not everybody's going to be eligible. There are height and weight requirements, and you have to have a certain iron content in your blood. So that's fine. They test to make sure that you are eligible, and if you are, they ask if you want to do it. Some people don't like the idea. Some people are like, oh, yeah, sure, why not?
And
my husband used to drive a tractor trailer, and every time he would come home, we never knew when he was going to be home. He would say, oh, is there a blood drive around? We'd look for a blood drive, and he'd go give a double unit. And then he didn't have to worry about it for 4 months. It was wonderful.
In light of what's going on with COVID-19, are there safety concerns? Do folks need to be vaccinated? What is the protocol there?
So, no, they do not need to be vaccinated. Everybody coming to a blood drive, regardless of vaccination status, has to be masked. If you come in and you don't have a mask, we will provide one for you. If you have had a vaccine, that is not disqualifying, even if you just had it a few days before. You just need to know what manufacturer and when you had it. And that should not be a disqualifying factor in giving blood. The biggest factors are blood pressure, low iron content, weight. If you weigh under 110 pounds, you're not eligible. We can't take that much blood from somebody who's that thin. It doesn't work.
In general, you folks need to, you know, be feeling well, and you do have a health screening, as you mentioned. So yes. Some of the incentives that you guys are offering at the Red Cross, it seems like there's an NFL partnership, chance to win a trip to the Super Bowl.
Yes. Anybody who donates between January 1st and January 31st is going to be entered into a drawing for 2 tickets to the Super Bowl in Los Angeles. And I will tell you, honestly, there's some sort of promotion every single month. Lately, it used to be you could get a $5 Dunkin' Donuts or Amazon gift certificate. They've been upping that to $10 because the partners, Amazon, Dunkin' Donuts, et cetera, they're very happy to help support the Red Cross by doing this.
Yeah, these incentives hopefully will get folks out to donate. And so where locally can folks go to donate that are scheduled?
So there are drives coming up. And as I said before, they can look them up on redcrossblood.org. And we have one coming up on the 25th at Livingston Manor at the firehouse from 1 to 6. That's January. Also in January, on that Thursday, the 27th, we have one at the Rock Hill Fire Department from 1 to 6. And then we have one on February 9th at the Ted Strobel Center in Monticello from 10 to 3. And we have one at St. George's Church on February 23rd in Jeffersonville from 1 to 6. Oh, I missed one. February 9th, we have one 1 to 6 at St. Joseph's Church in Wurtsboro. And that is in memory of our one of our parishioners who was horrifically killed in a motor vehicle accident while delivering mail for the Postal Service.
Mm-hmm. And what would you say to folks who may be a little concerned about safety? You mentioned that folks aren't coming out as much as they used to. What's the message you want to get out there?
The message is we have very strict safety protocols in place. We're keeping everybody 6 feet apart. We're not letting the place get overcrowded. Everybody is checked. If you're not feeling well, please don't come. But we're going to ask you if you're feeling well before you even walk in the door. And they're going to check you for a history. If they find any reason why you shouldn't give blood, they're going to stop you right there. But we need anybody and everybody who's willing to roll up their sleeves. We really do, because this has gotten so bad that there just is no blood supply. There's less than a one-day blood supply. And that's very scary. Blood doesn't sit on a shelf more than 30 days, but we're not even getting one day.
We've been speaking with Mia Hubbard from the American Red Cross. She wears many hats, but the main hat she's wearing today is to encourage folks to donate blood. The American Red Cross says there's a national blood crisis and they need help. You can find more information at the American Red Cross website, redcrossblood.org, or call 1-800-RED-CROSS. Mia, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We'll take a short break, and when we come back, Wayne Memorial Hospital's Director of Patient Services gives us a firsthand look at the COVID surge inside their doors. We'll be right back. This is Radio Chatskill.
A documentary like no other puts you right there in the heart of the movement.
I have no alternative but to lead a march to carry our grievances to the seat of government in the state of Alabama.
Stand where you are. This march will not continue.
From here to Montgomery, we will be there with you.
Saturday at noon on Radio Catskill.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb. This week on our show, in honor of the depths of winter, we're all about soup. We talk with Jen Lewis, author of the Chicken Soup Manifesto, to get her tips and recipes from around the world. We taste canned chicken stocks to find out which one we like best, and that's all coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. This week, in less than 48 hours, Wayne Memorial Community Health Center offices gave out roughly 10,000 free COVID rapid antigen tests. The hospital says they'll get another supply of free tests next week. That's on top of the record surges that hospitals across the country, including Wayne Memorial, are experiencing in COVID cases. This week, Wayne Memorial said they were at capacity at the dedicated COVID unit at the hospital with 7 COVID patients in the ER waiting for a bed. Most of the patients at the hospital are not vaccinated. Chandra Roberts, Director of Patient Care Services at Wayne Memorial Hospital, told WJFF's Jason Dole it's the worst she's seen since the pandemic began. We should note that Wayne Memorial is a financial supporter at WJFF.
Back at the beginning of the pandemic in 2020, our maximum capacity in any given time was about 13 patients. Last year, during our COVID peak, we stretched up to, 15 to 18 patients in our COVID unit. But definitely over this past 2 weeks, we've seen the largest surge we've ever experienced with, exactly as you mentioned before, our COVID unit was full. Our capacity is 20. And yes, we did have 7 people admitted and waiting in the emergency room for bed placement in our COVID unit.
Does that throw your protocols out of whack when that happens? I mean, how do you handle those spillover COVID patients?
Sure, absolutely it does. We do the best we can, and we try real hard to get in any extra staff to help take care of all those extra people. And I think we've done a pretty good job doing that. It's definitely not what I wish for anyone in healthcare to be experiencing right now. It is really a serious problem, that's for sure.
What are your biggest challenges right now?
Biggest challenge probably right now is staffing and, being able to provide support to the staff at the bedside. They can do the physical work, but sometimes the emotional toll is bigger than the physical portion as well. So we try every day to evaluate the situation and put our best effort forward to provide support, both in increased staffing as much as we can and emotional support, whatever way we can.
As you're seeing too many patients even for your COVID unit in the hospital, most of these folks are unvaccinated?
The majority are unvaccinated, yes.
So we know that Wayne Memorial launched a huge vaccine hesitancy campaign with its legacy doctors. Doctors have been treating patients and their families and community for decades. You know, how was that going, and what still needs to be done, and what could even be done to get more people vaccinated?
I think physicians need to continue having these conversations with their patients. Patients definitely need to be able to live develop a level of trust in the healthcare system and a level of trust with their physicians, and the fact that it is a new vaccine, we know that that's probably a lot of the reason for hesitancy, is people just are very unsure yet if it's a safe thing to do. However, you know, we're seeing less impact on patients who are vaccinated. When those vaccinated patients do come into the hospital, they're much less likely to be severely ill.
Well, that's good news. So you're seeing the beneficial impact of the vaccine. You're seeing it in real time. Do you ever have that conversation with people about trying to talk to them about vaccines?
Absolutely. Yeah. I was a former nurse manager of the COVID unit. So I was working in there pretty often to experience what those providers in there were going through as well. And I recognize that sometimes people just have a strong feeling against vaccination, and as healthcare providers, you know, that can be frustrating, because we recognize the impact that vaccination can make in people's outcomes. However, we are here to also provide care no matter what the circumstances are, whether people are vaccinated or not. So it's up to us to continue to care for people regardless.
Everything's been changing so much. We're like almost 2 years into this thing, and it's hard to keep track of what's going on, the new variants, new protocols, new recommendations from the CDC. Are you encountering any confusion from folks regarding things like when to get tested and what to do if you get a positive test or an exposure, or how long to quarantine and things like that?
Yes, it's difficult to keep up with frequent changes that we get coming down the get down our way, and you know, there are recommendations for the general public that are different than the recommendations for the healthcare providers, and that are different than our school age children. So everyone's quarantine requirements vary a little bit. The most recent being the lightening up of quarantine requirements down to about 5 days. And that's a good thing, because, you know, people who are not very sick can get back to work or get back to school sooner. But we're also finding that for some people that really are sick, 5 days isn't enough, and they could still be contagious at that point. So it really is a tough thing to handle, and definitely all the changes, there's kind of constant confusion over what the requirements are on a day-to-day basis.
It seems like one of the main ideas of this reduced period of quarantine is going, you know, quarantining for 5 days instead of 10. One of the main things that people got to keep in mind is that's if you're not experiencing symptoms at that point, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. The main point of it is don't go back to school or don't go back to work if you haven't been at least 24 hours with resolution of symptoms, especially a fever.
One of the lessons that I hope that we walk away from this whole period, if we ever get past this, is just the idea of, like, don't go to work or school if you're the least bit sick anyway, because you don't know what it could be.
Absolutely.
You can give it to other people. I mean, it seems like, you know, flu season was always tough in our area this time of year with the flu. And I just feel like I hope some of these precautions that we're taking stick so that, like, we don't go back to that.
Well, you know, in 22 years of being a nurse, I've never seen a flu season this severe. And I definitely have experienced recently that people are, you know, back to going out and about. And it's nice to be able to be active in the community. I'm all for that in good time, but right now it's still a scary time. It's still a tough time. We're still experiencing a lot of illness from it, and I know people don't want to be tied down or cooped up any longer than they have to, myself included, but we're still up against a real troublesome pandemic.
You know, saying that it's the worst flu season you've seen in a long time, does that add to your challenges?
I didn't say it was the worst flu season. I meant it's worse than any flu season that I've experienced in 22 years. The COVID pandemic has been worse than a flu season. We've actually seen cases of flu in the last 2 years drop, probably 2 years ago and even last winter, because people were staying home more. They weren't going out in public as much, and they were wearing masks. So flu really kind of dropped off for 2 years. We are expecting a resurgence of flu. We've seen a little bit so far, but we do expect that maybe we'll be seeing more flu this year than we have in the last 2 years as well.
Is that another level of complexity for you on the ground at the hospital, where like you gotta, somebody's got these symptoms, it could be COVID, could be flu, and you've got to, do you have to test
for
both?
Well, we test right away to determine whether they have COVID versus whether they have flu or RSV or something else.
Well, I thank you so much for taking this time to talk to us. I know I've been throwing lots of questions at you, and I'm wondering if there's anything that we didn't get to that you wanted to address, or any other topics that you want to share with folks while we've got you here.
Sure. I just feel that right now it's not a time to slide back on our mitigation efforts. I think it's important that people choose some type of mitigation effort to practice at this time, and whether it be social distancing or masking or vaccinating or simple hand hygiene, you know, if every person could practice some form of mitigation technique, that maybe our numbers would start coming down and take some burden off of our healthcare system across the country right now.
Okay. Well, Chandra Roberts, Director of Patient Care Services at Wayne Memorial Hospital, I know you're so busy, and I thank you so much for the work you're doing, and I thank you for taking this time to talk to us.
All right, thanks so much for taking the time.
We'll take a short break. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
We must continue to delve deeper into the philosophy of nonviolent resistance.
Hear Martin Luther King Jr.'s Path to Nonviolence, featuring excerpts from his talks and conversation with Dr. Dorothy Cotton of Dr. King's staff and King's eldest daughter, Yolanda King.
But when he was not about business, he was a bit of a cut-up. He was a jokester.
That's Martin Luther King Jr.'s Path to Nonviolence.
Monday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Fire officials say that the lethal smoke that killed 17 people in a Bronx high-rise fire last Sunday probably spread so rapidly because one simple action for containing just such a blaze failed amid the panic to escape. One resident who lived with his family in the third floor duplex where the fire broke out told the New York Post that in his haste, he forgot to close the apartment door behind him. Fire officials say that closing a door can be one of the most critical actions people can take to stop the spread and save lives when confronting a fire. We spoke with Brendan Cunningham of the White Lake Fire Company about fire safety and why it's so important in the winter.
Unfortunately, this time of year, everybody's trying to heat their house. It's cold. You know, we have a wind chill warning tonight, so everybody's looking for ways to heat their house and as quick as they can and how long they can. You know, they're trying space heaters and different methods. You got wood stoves and boilers, and a lot of people maybe can't afford the maintenance on them or cleaning them, so they just kind of go with it. And unfortunately, you know, we're seeing more and more fires.
Yeah, and I think that maybe some people don't know that when there is a fire, if this is happening, what they should do. So what are some of the tips for folks in case they happen to be in a fire? You know, one of the things that happened, I think, in one of them, I believe it was the one in the Bronx, was that folks didn't close the door when they left, and that caused smoke throughout the entire building.
Absolutely. If you have you smell smoke in your house, close as many doors as you can. And especially if you know what the fire room is, close that door immediately. That's going to slow the spread, and chances are it's going to keep it low enough so when we get there, we can put it out quick. You know, once you open the door and you let the oxygen, it's going to grow very fast. So it's going to starve for that oxygen. It's going to look for it. It's going to follow any chaseway or hallway or anything. So,
are there any kind of large apartment complexes or high rise apartment buildings in our area?
I'm sure you got Monticello, Liberty. You know, place like that. There's a lot of big complexes and stuff. Nothing the size of like the Bronx, but absolutely it could be this problem.
What about building codes? Do the new building codes for fire apply to these older buildings or these larger buildings that you mentioned in Monticello?
Sure, absolutely. I imagine they would. It's all about, you know, manpower and keeping up on the violations and stuff. You know, this day and age, everybody's short staffed. So, you know, there's a lot out there, and I'm sure the code enforcement and building departments are having a hard time keeping up with everything, and people are trying every way they can to cut corners and save money.
Are there education initiatives that inform not only tenants, but just anyone really that go on regularly? What can you tell us about some of the education efforts that you guys are putting out there for our community?
Sure. I mean, the county has a website, and, you know, the John Household does a great job with that, putting out safety tips, whether it's cold weather or heating, you know, heating your house, you know, cleaning, make sure you clean your chimneys, all that stuff. We try to push on social media as much as we can when we can. You know, there's a lot of safety tips out there, especially with like space heaters. You know, you don't want to plug a space heater into an extension cord, plug it straight into an outlet. Keep 3 feet around, all, you know, 360. Don't put anything within three feet. You know, don't leave them unattended. If you're purchasing them, you know, try to purchase, you know, one that maybe more safety mode. Some of them have tip over modes. So if the oil tips over, it'll automatically shut off. You know, leave it on a hard surface. Don't put it on carpets or rugs or near drapes or curtains or things like that. So, I mean, just got to keep in mind, you know, what you have and what's the safest way to do it.
And would you recommend that folks create and practice an escape plan in case there is a fire?
Absolutely. And not just create one, but practice it. You know, make sure everybody knows it, you know, what to do. You know, if you're going to leave, close the door behind you, get out, make sure everybody's out and get, you know, get to your safety route. You know, even if you practice it once a month, you know, especially in the wintertime when you're using your heat sources more. And don't ever heat your house with your oven, you know, your stove, especially gas appliances. You know, you're going to create carbon monoxide.
If you can leave your home and you have this plan, there are things that you should do, like we mentioned before. Close the door behind you if you leave a room where there is fire or smoke. If you live in a building, pull the fire alarm, alert your neighbors. What are some other things that folks should do if they know it's safe to leave the home?
I mean, the biggest thing is get out as fast as you can. Call 911 as fast as you can. Get us, you know, get the resources rolling. You know, we're, you know, this county's 99% volunteers. And, you know, we got to, you know, it's the middle of the night. We're getting out of bed ourselves, getting dressed. And, you know, if it's a storm or something, we're warming our vehicles up. So it's going to take time. But the faster you get out, the faster you call 911, you know, the faster we can get there and do what we do.
And if someone can't escape their home, also the first thing they should do is call 911.
Absolutely, and give your location. Try to give it the best description you can of your house, your location, what room you're in, you know, even side of the house. You know, it's a big help.
Should folks try to mitigate smoke or fire by, like, stuffing cracks or areas with rags or towels or anything?
Sure. You know, your heat's going to rise. You know, your smoke and heat are going to rise to the top. So the lower you can get is the better. Stay low. You know, if you can lay right on the floor, that's your best chance.
You mentioned the cold weather, definitely chilly, and we've got a snowstorm moving in too. Yeah. Folks may not think too much about fire, but what are some other things specific to cold weather that you want folks to know?
Yeah, I mean, it's important to stay safe. I mean, stay warm, but you got to stay safe doing it, you know, the same way. You know, keep things clear. You know, even your exhaust, you know, if you got an exhaust on the side of the house or where snow may fall off or something, make sure everything is cleared. You don't want to create carbon monoxide back into the house if you don't have a proper vent. You know, that'll create carbon monoxide backup. So make sure your carbon monoxide detectors are working, your smoke detectors are working. Check them weekly. Those are very important. They're going to get you out fast. You know, they're going to be your first notification, you know, most of the time. So please make sure your smoke detectors work. You have carbon monoxide detectors, and just stay warm and try your best. I mean, it's going to be rough. It's going to be windy. It's going to be a lot of snow.
We've spoken to local firefighters in the area over the last few months about the shortage of firefighters and the need for volunteers. I imagine that need is ongoing.
Absolutely. I'm part of the Sullivan County Recruitment Retention Task Force, and we're doing whatever we can to get, you know, and not just, you know, getting people in, but education and trying to help departments with recruitment and retention and ways to draw members in. And, you know, these fires certainly show the shortage on days. You know, it depends. Not every day we're short, but there's days we are, and we could certainly use the help. And, you know, some departments hurt more than others, and we're pushing and trying to get as many people in the door as we can. So, I mean, if anybody's interested, you know, just email joinsullivanfire@gmail.com. If you have any questions or concerns, you can email us, and we can help you out if you're interested in joining, or if you're a company looking for help on ways to help with your recruitment and retention. You know, we're there. You know, we have Facebook and Instagram, Join Sullivan Fire. So we're there to help anybody, and we're looking forward to, you know, increasing the ranks over the years. And we have for anybody that is a first responder, we got a seminar coming up next month and February 12th for all first responders. And it's you know, ways to increase the morale and increase ways to keep your members' retention and recruitment and retention, you know, committees and how you can maybe boost your ranks in the fire service. So we're always looking for volunteers. And, you know, this time of day, we just ran three working fires or a fast team in the last 4 days. And, you know, it gets tiring on the guys, you know, to keep coming out every time. So, you know, we're leaving work, we're leaving home, whatever it is. Sometimes we're going into work late, like today. So any little bit of help it goes a long ways.
Talking to Brendan Cunningham about fire safety and prevention. Be prepared and be alert to help keep you and your neighbors safe so we don't have more tragedies occurring. Brendan, thank you so much for joining us with this important information today.
Yes, thanks for having me.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. Artist Christy Johnson explores personal transformation through the stitching of dreams and intentions. As a teacher, Johnson offers workshops in natural dyeing and embroidery and has created kits and booklets for students and DIYers. Her January workshops are sold out. In her book, Mystical Stitches, she combines the craft of embroidery with a spiritual element, introducing 200 symbols you can use to set an intention and create personal icons to wear or embellish items in the home. WJFF's Jesse Spisato spoke with Johnson last summer just after her book was published.
I wanted to start by talking about your book, Mystical Stitches, which came out in June. First of all, congratulations. It's so beautiful.
Well, thank you.
You talked a little bit in one of your Instagram stories about the journey sort of leading up to the creation of the book, how it took 10 years and began with you making those hand-embroidered song lyric pieces, which were super cute. I was wondering, like, what was the impetus for making those in the first place? Why embroidery? Why song lyrics?
Right. That's a really good question. I think it was just in a time in my life when I was kind of trying to find my footing as an artist, like trying to find where I became an individual in what I was working on, especially because I studied fashion at an art school. And so I was exposed to sort of art as a concept, as a sort of greater goal in the world and everything. But I wasn't necessarily, because I studied fashion, it was very much like you have a concept for your collection and you, you know, that collection needs to be sold.
Right.
Yeah. And so I think embroidery for me was sort of like a way of finding a form of expression that felt a little more unique to me. And within sort of the art world, trying to figure out a way, because I had studied painting when I was in high school. I went to a magnet art school. I was doing painting there. So I had a lot of sort of experience with, you know, that sort of field, but painting never really felt like my trajectory. And so embroidery was this beautiful way of kind of mixing those two worlds, mixing the world of fashion and the world of art, and just allowing them to continue to exist together, I guess. Yeah.
That's cool. How did you wind up working on embroidery with clothing eventually?
Right. I had made a few pieces of my own, you know, for my own clothes. The first sort of step of making embroidery on clothing was the person who I was working for approached me after I was working on these embroidered song lyrics. And he was like, hey, do you want to make some designs? Cause we had worked together for many years by that point. I think we had been working together for like 3 or 4 years at that point. And so we knew each other. He knew my working style. He knew my art, and was really supportive of that. And he said, you know, I want to make these denim shirts that are made in the USA, and they're that sort of vintage denim that, and like chambray that just feels really nice. But I want to embroider them and have a little more psychedelic, a little bit more 70s style embroidery. And he actually referenced the book Native Funk and Flash. And I don't know if I had ever seen that book before that moment. Mm-hmm. But that was a big part of what his inspiration for it was. And that, I was like, that's, you know, I've always been really into 70s art and 70s sort of counterculture clothes and everything. And so I was like, yes, absolutely. So that was kind of how I got started with embroidering on clothes, I guess, was really kind of being invited to.
That's awesome. I mean, it seems like such a natural trajectory anyway, like given that you went to fashion school and stuff. And then you found like your medium. I was interested in one of the first pages of your book is a collection of sort of all the embroidery thread that's been ripped out, demonstrating, you know, that you've made a bunch of mistakes along the way, which I loved. Why was that important for you to share with your readers?
Because I think that there's a lot of times, like, the reaction that I'll get to a lot of my work is like, oh, you know, I would love to try embroidery, but I'm just not that good at it. And I'm like, neither am I all the time, you know, and it felt like that was really important, especially as, you know, we live in this culture where we see a lot of the end results, but we don't see a lot of the process. And so introducing that concept of just like, I made a lot of mistakes. I restitched one of the flower pages. I think I restitched it 3 or 4 times before I finally, and I went to the point of cutting out stitches, restitching it. And then I just scrapped the thing, you know, all of probably 2 days worth of work on this piece before getting to the final piece. And that was just one page of, I don't know how many pages are in the Sybil's library, but one page of many, 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 many. And so, yeah, just kind of encouraging people to be okay with the idea that it's not going to turn out right the first time. Yeah,
that's really encouraging. It's so true. The process is so much messier than what we see in the end, usually.
Yeah. And as a teacher, it's, you know, there's a lot of like, oh, it doesn't look right yet. And I'm like, of course it doesn't look right yet. You're learning and, you know, encouraging that the embracing of that aspect of learning, and it's okay for things to not turn out right. And maybe you don't even need to rip them out. Maybe it just like goes into a pile. For me, like, you know, a lot of these pieces that I make that didn't necessarily turn out the way that I wanted to, they'll end up in a pile that I'll pull them out of that pile 6 years later and be like, oh, this is perfect to like patch into some quilt or something like that. And so I think everything, all of these things sort of start to piece themselves together as, you know, these failures. And just like in life where we see like the failures, the things that went horribly wrong in our mind, we can look back on a lot of times and be like, oh, I'm actually really glad that that happened. Otherwise life could have turned out like, maybe I wouldn't have been as appreciative, or I wouldn't have really understood what was at stake, or, you know, having so much more of a broader viewpoint of things, we can understand that our failures actually feed us. So yeah, having that be a big part of the book felt really important.
Yeah, that's such a nice like way to look at life in general, I feel like. Good lesson.
Totally.
In your book, you write that it's more than simply a series of, you know, projects to complete. Can you talk a little bit more about the like spiritual aspect to Mystical Stitches?
Yeah. So for me, embroidery becomes this beautiful way of really slowing down. Like embroidery in the act of embroidery is a meditation, because you have to really focus. I mean, you can technically watch TV while you embroider. I have watched movies embroidering, you know, it's like, doesn't exist outside of that. But I do think that, being able to take that opportunity to really sit and focus on something that works so slowly compared to what we're used to the rate that we're used to things happening at. And so being able to take that time and allow it to be sort of a mental and emotional processing, as well as sort of intention setting and deciding the way that things do get to be. And a lot of the times I will take an embroidery and a design as an opportunity to work through a concept or work through, you know, something that I want to work towards. And that is not to say that I'm just sitting there the whole time being like, things are going to be great. And, you know, life is going to be beautiful. Like, I think it's really important to note that a lot of the times, you know, because the embroidery process takes so long, a lot of like negative stuff comes up and I'm like, oh, maybe I'm not good enough, or maybe that's not meant for me, or this or that. And I think that's just as important to the process, to any sort of intention setting or any sort of guidance that we're trying to find and move towards in our lives. I think it's really important to be allowed to bring those emotions up. And I think that the actual physicality of embroidery, where we're literally taking a needle and thread up through the fabric and then bringing it back down underneath the fabric, and we've got this sort of like everything that we're seeing on the surface, and then an entirely different visual on the backside of it, sort of the underside, the working side of it. And I think that that kind of allows itself to be a little bit of a metaphor for what we are actually working with in our own minds as well, where we've got, you know, what we desire and what we want that seems to make all sorts of perfect sense on the front side. But then we're working with a lot of stuff that's underneath it all. And it's kind of like, well, you know, maybe we need to kind of work with that a little bit too. So.
Wow. Like you said, that is just like, there's so many metaphors here for life. Amazing. It's also like such a good reminder that meditation can come in so many forms. Like it doesn't have to just mean like sitting down with your meditation app or whatever, which is awesome. But like, that's not the only thing that meditation means, you know, like it could look like this, which is really cool. This is my last question about the book. Who do you imagine it to be for? Like, is it for people who already have some level of experience with embroidery, or do you think it can be for beginners as well?
I think it can definitely be for beginners as well. I tried to include everything, like from the very basics of the materials. but there are a few details like that I think, you know, watching a video or seeing somebody experience it in person, like how do I hold the hoop? Or, you know, there's a few things sort of, especially like as I consider it after writing the book, it's like, oh, I didn't mention like how to tie off a thread. You know, there's little details like that. But I do think that I did design it for beginners. I tried to make the stitch instructions as clear as possible because that's something that I find really difficult to understand where I'm like, oh, in this one illustration, the stitcher has created three different motions, but they didn't tell me that. Like, I didn't know that this was going to take three passes. And so I tried to, as clearly as possible, illustrate the stitches so that you, like, your needle's going in here and it's coming out here, so that there was more of a full understanding for people who hadn't have any experience stitching before.
That's great. That makes me feel like I could actually read your book and follow along.
Yeah. Yeah. And I did like a whole series of videos for how to do each stitches that are free on my website. Cause I wanted to be able to offer that for people as well to kind of like, okay, it's one thing to read something in a book, but some skills, especially when there is like sort of a movement involved, like watching a video of it is sort of like, oh, okay.
Wow. Yeah. That seems super helpful. That's great.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I wanted to talk about some Sullivan County things as well. You painted the latest dove on the Sullivan Catskills Dove Trail, which is really exciting. That's such a fun thing, I feel like, to be a part of. What was that experience like? And how did you decide what to paint?
I just really thought about, I mean, this time of the year is, you know, the best time of the year to ask me about living in Sullivan County.
I know.
Although, I mean, I actually really do love winter and I love the quietness of, you know, being under a few feet of snow. But the way that I decided is just like sort of what is surrounding me that I'm inspired by and the natural world is. And it was working with, you know, one of the most beautiful parts I find about this area is all of the bodies of water and, you know, being able to always kind of being within like an arm's reach of a river or a lake or something. And sort of seeing it driving around, always having these beautiful sunset lake views. And so that was a big part is sort of like sunset, water, and the garden. And so there's a little grouping of flowers sort of emerging out of the rushing waters. So yeah.
Awesome. I can't wait to see it. That sounds so fun. And I also feel like, yeah, all the water, bodies of water here are definitely one of my favorite things about Sullivan County for sure.
Yeah.
Well, you kind of touched on this, but, you know, lastly, like you teach workshops here and obviously you created your book here. What makes Sullivan County a great place to actually make your art?
I think it feels very grounding here. Like there are a lot of things that are just really encouraging stillness and encouraging slowness, you know, not needing to be rushing through the day. I live right around a bunch of farms. And so there's a lot of trucks kind of going, farm trucks going slowly by the house every day. I can see cows down the road and there's always this feeling of just like nothing needs to happen immediately. Like we are all like doing what we need to do and making sure that happens, like making sure we're getting done what we need done. But it just feels like there is a sort of embrace of that, the lifestyle of like, you know, it's okay that you don't have, you know, every single store that you could possibly imagine at an arm's reach. And it's okay that places close at 5 and it's okay that things are not open during the week some of the times. I really like the way that it feels like this area really encourages just sort of an embrace of that sort of natural state of things, the natural speed and the natural evolution of the way that the seasons evolve is another part that I love about Sullivan County. Is I grew up in Florida, so I didn't really know much about snow or anything. I was like, wow, that actually, the feeling of having, you know, 4 months of the year where kind of nothing can get done, there's no ability, you know, we're just throwing wood into the wood stove for 4 months. And it really, it's really, what's the word for it? sort of nourishing, I guess, having that time to kind of go back inside, stay inside. And anytime you do go outside, everything's really silent. You know, I go outside to let the chickens out and it's just, everything's really still and quiet. And that feels really, feels really nourishing.
Totally. Yeah. I feel like you're making me excited for the winter, like just to get back to work in a way that like it's hard to do now, you know?
Yeah. And I always think like if I, you know, I love gardening and I love growing flowers and things, but I wonder, like, would I do it all year round if I had the option to? Like, is it such an intense part of my summer because that's the only time of the year that I can actually grow anything outside?
Yeah, I think so. That's what my feeling is for sure. Well, this has been so awesome to chat. Thank you so much for talking to me. Cool. I'm really just looking forward to seeing your dove and checking out your book further.
Yeah, go ahead and check it out. Yeah, it's definitely for beginners. So if you want to, if you're feeling intimidated by it, just spend some time with it, you know, take some deep breaths. That's what I always say. That's what I always do when I'm learning something new from a book. I'm just like, okay, I'm going to give myself an hour to just try and understand the initial concept here. So yeah.
That's great advice. Well, thanks again, Christy. Talk to you soon.
You can find more about Christy Johnson at her website, mixedcolor.net. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Before we go, on program note, we're honoring Martin Luther King Jr. during the holiday weekend with 16 hours of special programming starting at noon today with the documentary, The Second Battle of Selma. That will air in place of the Janice Adams Show. But before we go, Janice Adams will share her memory of Dr. King. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening. Stay warm, stay safe, wear a mask.
Thank you, Dr. King. All my life, I've been touched by history. As a child of the civil rights era, I've lived the sting of current events. A journalist, I've chronicled our collective path for 30 years. A historian, I've put those events into perspective, into context of time and journeys and destinies, and known the power of history to cleanse and to heal. I was 10 when I met Dr. King at New York's Riverside Church. Because my aunt was a member of Riverside's professional choir, I had a front row seat when Dr. King spoke there, newly returned from the wars of Montgomery. Rosa Parks had just kept her historic seat, and a battalion of everyday people had risen to the occasion by taking to their feet. With that, they began and sustained the 385-day boycott that would launch the modern civil rights era, the fight for human rights in America that persists to this day. I met Dr. King on the receiving line at Riverside. "And what are you doing for our people?" he said. I told him my cousin and I and two others had desegregated New York City schools. He told me that what I was doing was important. He then lifted my awestruck chin and called me pretty. Growing up a child of the integration generation in those days when pretty and important were about as good as a Negro girl could ever hope to feel, you could say I was raised by Dr. King. The next day, as my mother brushed my hair for school, I saw a different me in the mirror. At 8 years old, northern white parents had spat on me and torn my clothes for trespassing what they saw as turf and I saw as school. Now, touched by King, I felt cleansed. I was a child raised, yes, by Dr. King. His words liberated me and made me feel what every person, man, woman, child, wants to feel: validated, heard, understood. That brief act of caring, of generosity, that charge that Dr. King gave a 10-year-old girl is the gift of spirit I share with my audiences everywhere I go. In this life, said my grandmother, all things are one. The gifts we are given are gifts for the common good. We must walk the walk, talk the talk, live the life. In this world, too, as my grandfather would say, let no one contaminate your mind. I'm Janice Adams.
So
Support comes from the Homestead School, Montessori education, preschool through early college with campuses in Glens Bay and Hurleyville. Building the intelligence, creativity, connection, and skills for an ecological future since 1978. Homesteadschool.com. From the River Reporter newspaper in Narrowsburg, New York, riverreporter.com. And from listener donations at wjffradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville.